going down to a few inches because it was an angled cell. And in the cell there was a wooden board attached, and there was a wooden block for your pillow. You had no bedding, and you were on a strict bread and water diet for the first day, and then after that you were entitled to something like 1 ounce of cheese and 1 ounce of bread and 1 ounce or half ounce of butter or something. And that was for the second 2 days. Now, you're also given what they call an oakum of rope, and it was tarred rope, and what you had to do is to peel the rope with your fingers and pick it. And it was very tough because it was very thick tar rope, and you pulled it to pieces until it was nothing more than just like fine hair. And at the end of the day, each day, they would weigh the rope when they gave it to you, a pound of rope, say, and they would weigh all the bits that you picked at the end of the day and the bits that you had unpicked, and they would take the unpicked part away from you and they'd give you a fresh piece the next day. And on the third day they would say to you, right, your punishment is up, but you don't leave until you've unpicked all the parts that you haven't been able to get through. So the third day they would open the cell door, your punishment was over, but you couldn't leave until you'd unpicked all that remained of the oakum.
What happened?
It was just threw it away. And your fingers would be absolutely raw bleeding, where it would just tear right into this thick tarred. Right. That was the punishment, and then you were allowed on the upper deck for 30 minutes in the evening, between 5 and 5:30, and you would be taken up there by a sentry, and you actually had a sentry on the outside of the cell there in case there was any problems, you know.
What was the role of the master at arms?
Master at arms was in charge of the discipline on board, complete control of the discipline, and he had three petty officers, regulating petty officers, two or three leading patrolmen, and that was his staff. And they dealt with all the mail on board.
Ham sandwich. Ham.
Yeah, that's fine. Sorry.
That's what you were saying. Oh, I perhaps ought to turn on the reel. Come on. Ernie Smith, Reel 3. Sorry, you're talking about the role of the Master at Arms.
Yes, so the Master at Arms was responsible for the ship's discipline, the welfare of the ship, ship's company, the mail, and he had sections of on board in his office where there was a leave office, there was a discipline office, and dealt with all the messing on board. So in other words, if a sailor came on board, he was allocated a mess, and that was all done through the Master Arms and his staff, the regulating staff, and basically responsible for the discipline on board and making sure that nothing untoward was happening.
What were your duties in the Birmingham?
I was quarterdeck division, and on that division I was responsible for scrubbing the decks in the morning. We'd get up at half past 5 in the morning, go out there and scrub the decks and polish the brass work, and basically keep that part of ship clean. That was, you know, my part of ship. And then we rehearsed action stations, and my action station was in Y Turret. That was part of the thing. Then we had damage control stations, so it was exercising and cleaning ship on a day-to-day basis.
Tell me about your action station in Y Turret.
Well, Y Turret was the after turret, a 6-inch triple turrets. And I had the job on there of lining up two dials, actually, two pointers, putting, I have no idea why I did that, but I did, and that was part of the fire control system. And within that turret, there was a turret officer, a lieutenant, and there was about 8 or 9 other sailors in that turret, in firing different firing situations, positions, you know, with the shells, with the cordite, with the handling.
Were you dressed in a particular way?
Yes, when we were in the turret, we were dressed in number 8, which was denim with anti-flash gear, anti-flash balaclava and gloves.
Tell me about your damage control role as well.
We were part of a quarterdeck damage control party, and we would be under the direction of a petty officer, a quarterdeck petty officer, and any damage that occurred within that quarterdeck area or beneath, we were responsible for, and in terms of either firefighting or damage control. And we exercised very often, you know, they would say they would make a pipe for exercise, for fire in the lower part of the deck four, or quarter deck or something, or in the rum store, and we would go down there and rehearse shoring it up or putting a fire out or whatever, you know.
Can you tell me about the structure of your department, the chain of authority?
Yes, quarter deck division consisted of some boys, ordinary seamen, then there was able seamen, then you had the petty officer in charge of the quarter deck division. You had a midshipman, also as part of the quarter deck division, a sub lieutenant, and your division officer, which would be a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander. And you were actually a sort of a family. You had the quarter deck division, then you had forecastle division, then you had top division, the three divisions, and the whole ship was separated in those three areas.
Where did you, or what were the duties of the Birmingham whilst you were on board?
Really, showing the flag. It was immediately after the war, and we sailed in February of 1947, and in fact, after 2 days at sea, we were in the Bay of Biscay, and the boiler blew on there, killed three of the ship's company, and we had to return back to Portsmouth, and they refitted a new boiler in there, so we were there for 6 weeks. When we got the new boiler, then we sailed, went out to Gibraltar, through the Suez Canal, and then immediately to Singapore. And this was only a year after the Japanese had capitulated in Singapore. So it was quite an interesting time to be there, you know, still with the sort of scars of war around. And that was our base. And from there, we went to a place called Trincomalee, which is now Sri Lanka, but was part of Ceylon. Called Ceylon in the old days. We spent a lot of time in that area as well, showing the flag, basically.
Can you tell me about your shore leave during those days?
Well, because of boy seamen, we were very limited with shore time. And if we went ashore, say at 12 o'clock, we had to be back on board by 4 or 5 o'clock. So you really go ashore and do a bit of sightseeing, places like Calcutta, Madras, South Africa. You would go ashore, have a look around, knowing that you need to be back in 2 or 3 hours, you know, so it wasn't sort of a long period of time. In any event, you had very little money to go ashore with, so, you know.
So you weren't allowed out in the evenings?
No, not at all, no.
A officially, were boy sailors were they allowed to drink alcohol?
No, they weren't, but they did, of course. Yeah, given the opportunity and a fair wind.
And well, you mentioned other sailors in your mess, other ratings getting a rum ration. I understand that that's not the case for boy sailors.
No, you had to be 21 before you were allowed to have a rum ration. And so it was. That was very strict, and very strict the way that the rum was dished out. Actually, what the boys did have on board was what they called limers, which was quite interesting. It came in a barrel, very much the same as rum, but it was lime juice. And you had a couple of glasses of that every day, and that was supposed to. They say it was for scurvy, but. Who knows, you know, but it was a traditional thing. So, where the rum rats had their rum, we young salts had our lime juice.
So how did you get alcohol in this?
Well, only by going ashore and buying either a bottle of beer or say going to India and going to one of those arak houses, you know, that raw spirit that they sold for a rupee or something. And that's the only way you could do it, you know.
What about entertainment on board? What facilities for weather?
There wasn't any really. In those days, movies were few and far between. It wasn't until later on that we started getting sort of films on board, you know, the latter part of the commission, but the earlier part there was no film. Basically no entertainment. It was just a rigid routine of the ship. When you were at sea, you were training, you were exercising, you were cleaning, or you were in your hammock.
What about sports and games on deck or things like that?
No, it didn't happen. No, but when obviously we had a football team, we had a cricket team. Whenever we went ashore somewhere, they would go ashore and play, but not on board. No.
Any other hobbies during your time on the Burnie? In the Burnie?
We had a fun time for me was when we went down to South Africa. We had what they call the annual musketry competition, and we went up to Tabletop Mountain with our 303 rifles, and we had to do our annual musketry course, that was quite good fun, you know. Throwing off a few rounds, and you were marked on it, and you got your marksmanship badge if you passed. Yeah.
How long were you away from home during that?
2 years, 9 months.
How did you keep in contact with people?
Actually, the only person that really wrote to me, my father wrote from time to time, but Molly was the one that was writing to me and sending me food parcels. And she wrote every week, basically, yeah. No. Father wrote now and again. My mother didn't write very good English, and so I didn't hear much from her. My father would write probably once a month. And Molly would write, well, religiously every week to me. And a parcel every month, yeah.
Was your mail censored?
No, it wasn't. No. After the war, there was didn't seem that there was any need for it to be censored, you know.
Can you remember, do you have any particular recollection about any members of the ship's company, any stories or anecdotes relating to the Birmingham?
I do remember that there was a almost riot on there, mutiny almost. What mutiny is putting a very strong term, really. But it was in the cook's mess, and the cooks had been saving their rum up for some celebration or whatever. And they got together and they drank all this rum, and they were absolutely out of their mind drunk. And they were battened down, the master at arms and his staff and marines went down and battened the hatches down on them, because they were terrifying in the way that they were they were behaving in a, or mutinous they were. And
what were they doing?
Well, it was just being violent, you know, clubs. Sorry,
we were talking about the Cook's uprising, if you can call it that. Can you tell me what they were doing and when that was?
Well, this was about a year into the commission. There had been a number of disobedience problems with the Cooks on board. There had been a number of fights, both on board and Cooks going ashore, fighting amongst themselves. My understanding at the time was that some of these Cooks had been cleared out of the detention centre and sent on board the ship, so they came with a fairly strong criminal background anyway. They were the nucleus of the problems on the ship, and they were 1 minute food bashing, getting your food together and feeding you, and then when they were off duty, getting down to their mess deck, getting drunk and causing all sorts of problems, disobedience problems.
How were they dealt with?
A number of them was taken off the ship, court-martialed, and imprisoned.
Do you remember any other significant events or anything about any of the personalities in the ship's company?
We had a number of unfortunate accidents on board. An officer falling over the side and falling on what they called a catamaran, a wooden float where they used to paint the ship's side. And he was killed on that. There was one or two other unfortunate accidents on board. And it was, as I say, a very unlucky ship. And it seemed that this air of foreboding and depression pervaded the whole ship, you know. I can't even remember any of the names of the seamen on board, other than a guy called Lawrence, who was a boy seaman with me at St. Vincent, was also in my mess deck on the Birmingham. But apart from that, there was no bonding whatsoever on what I can't remember who the petty officer in charge of us was or anything, you know. It erased from my memory.
When did you come to leave the Birmingham?
We came back in 1949, middle of 49, I think. That's after two and a half years or so, and then went back into went for a long leave, and then went back to Royal Naval Barracks, and it was then that I decided to apply to become a leading patrolman and go into the regulating branch.
Had you been a naval seaman up until that point?
Yes, I had. I'd been promoted ordinary seaman on the Belfast, on the Birmingham, and then able seaman. And then when I came off the ship, I applied to do a leading seaman's course, and then eventually a regulating course.
Can you tell me about those courses and where they were held?
Well, the leading seaman's course was at was in Royal Naval Barracks, Portsmouth. And it was a few months after that I decided to apply to become a regulator, part of the regulating branch. And that was at Whale Island. And I immediately took to the fact that there was, we were involved in ship's law, that's LAW, not LORE. And I found it absolutely fascinating. And we were given a copy of the Queen's regulations and Admiralty instructions with all the and courts martial procedure, and we learned basic law, and we also learned how to become a policeman on shore, and how to become a policeman on board the ship, and that was a sort of 3 month course, and came away from there as a what they call a leading patrolman. Then changed the name to leading regulator, but it was a like a leading seaman, but in the regulating branch.
And after you completed that course,
I was then drafted down to HMS Osprey in Weymouth, in Portland, and I did a couple of years down there on the Royal Naval Patrol.
Can we just establish the year that you went to HMS Osprey?
That would have been 1951.
And what did your duties there involve?
Well, that was basically we worked on 24-hour shifts, and we acted as policemen. We were in jeeps, lorries, and we went around the town. We did foot patrols, and because it was a naval garrison town, and we were responsible for policing it with the local police.
And how did you do that?
Well, we were stationed at Portland. We had an office at Portland. We had cells there as well, and we would go out in teams, pair up together, be in radio control with base and the vehicle, and we'd go to a part of Weymouth, say outside of Weymouth Pier, where the dance hall was, and then we'd get out the vehicle and we'd foot patrol for maybe half an hour, then we'd call in, and then we'd go back to the vehicle and go to another part of town and just generally police the town, and then go back 11:30 at night time, go back to Portland and wait the sailors coming back through the dockyard gate. So a policing job. Yeah.
And what would happen if you found sailors who were fighting or were drunk and disorderly?
We'd pick them up and take them back down by we had a Black Mariah there, and take them back to the cell block, and we incarcerate them overnight, and then the next day would return them to their ship, and with whatever charges were relevant, really.
What would happen if a sailor was involved in an incident involving a civilian?
Well, we worked very closely with the police. In fact, part of our duties was to remain at the police headquarters, and our radios were linked to the police. And whenever an incident occurred, and they would relate on through the radio whether civilians were involved, the police would then make a decision on whether we would deal with the servicemen, or they would want to deal with the servicemen. And if it was a minor infringement, they would pass the serviceman, the sailor, over to us, and we would return him to his ship with whatever charges were involved. If it was a very serious nature, somebody that had a serious fight, a wounding or something, they would then take charge of that sailor and treat him as a civilian and charge him as a civilian.
And what sort of uniform did you wear?
We wore sailor's uniform with white belt, white gaiters, and an armband with naval patrol on it. And we had handcuffs, but no nightstick, no batons.
And what was the structure of your department?
Well, we had a master at arms. We had a naval provost marshal who was in charge. We had a master at arms. we had regulating petty officers for each watch, and then we had a series of leading patrolmen on each watch. So we probably have a full complement of about 20 people.
And what about your living arrangements at that point?
Well, we had mess decks and cabins within the Naval Patrol headquarters.
Were they the same arrangements as on board?
They're slightly different. We had individual cabins. We had our own cook that was posted to the Naval Patrol headquarters, who did all the cooking for us. And we, although we were isolated as a unit, our parent establishment was HMS Osprey, which was just down the road through the dockyard. So for purposes of pay or any other reasons, medical, dental, we would go into HMS Osprey as a parent establishment.
How were you regarded by...
Hated. Absolutely hated. Whenever you talk, even now, whenever I meet people, they always say, here comes that bloody crusher. They used to call us a crusher, you know. They were terrified of us, you know.
Were you authorised to deal with officers as well?
Yes. Yes. Obviously, we dealt with them on a completely separate level. In fact, when eventually I ended up as the Deputy Naval Provost Marshal of the Far East, and that was late 60s, under the Defence of the Realm Act, I had awesome powers there, dealing with officers, civilians, and ratings. And yeah, that was quite an interesting thing out there. But yes, we did. I mean, if an officer was found ashore drunk, we would pick him up, we'd place him in a vehicle, and we'd contact the Naval Provost Marshal, who was the Lieutenant Commander, and he would deal with it on a personal level. If it was a Chief Petty Officer or a Petty Officer, we would deal with it ourselves and take whatever steps were necessary. Providing we always called him Chief or Petty Officer, but it cut no ice with us, you know, rank cut no ice with us. We had a job to do and we did it.
You told me that your nickname, you were called Crushers.
Yeah.
That must have had some basis in fact.
I don't know, because I mean, going back into Nelson's time, of course, we were known as ship's corporals. And there was a master at arms on the ship, even in the times of Nelson, and then there was the ship's corporals, who were the current regulators. Where the name Crusher came from, I really don't know. Somebody said it's to do with crushing somebody's spirit, you know, and willpower, and making sure that that you were there, that you were responsible for enforcing your will on them if needs be. Because mostly you were dealing with people who'd had too much to drink. And I was always of the opinion that people who were ashore, normally thoroughly nice people, had gone ashore, had a couple of drinks. There was no reason for you or anybody else to start getting belligerent with them. They needed help, not discipline really, you know. Just needed to be looked after.
That continued for 2 years, I think.
Yes.
What happened to you after that?
Then I was drafted back to, would you believe, HMS St. Vincent, the boys' training establishment. I went back there as a regulating petty officer. I was promoted to RPO. I've got my chronological order wrong. After the Portland Naval Patrol, I was posted out to Malta on the staff of Lord Louis Mountbatten, and I worked in the fleet mail office out there for him. And at the time, we had by time now, we had a young son, a few months old, and Molly followed me out there, and she lived out in Malta for two and a half years, and with our little our baby boy, and that was a job, as I say, as a petty officer. I'd been promoted to petty officer and worked in the Fleet Mail office.